opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon.
Well, good afternoon.
We're all ready. There's no chaos in here. We don't know what to do. We're all confused.
Oh, yeah, I'm red hot and rolling.
All right, so we got Aaron.
And Bill.
And Bob.
Right on, Bob. Gonna give our guest a phone call right now?
Right on, Aaron.
Right. We originally lured everyone in and told them we were going to have Bill Hyde on this morning, or this afternoon. But we're going to have him on in the future. He had a death in the family, so not pleasant. So we've got two people on for you today. We have the vice president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, and I did not know about them. You can find all that information, by the way, on our program always. Contact information for us, sponsorship information, all that stuff. And all the show archives, you can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. And so I listed a whole bunch of stuff for both of these guests because they're really interesting and they're into a lot of different things. So Robert is the senior fellow and vice president for external affairs at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. He's also a senior advisor to Democracy Prep Public Schools, a network of high-performing charter schools based in Harlem. He writes and speaks extensively on education and education reform issues with an emphasis on literacy, curriculum, teaching, and urban education. After 20 years in journalism, including senior positions at Time and Business Week, he became a fifth-grade teacher at a struggling South Bronx public school in 2002. So I think that's kind of a fun career track.
No, that's not all.
Actually, he did the backwards career track for me. I started in teaching and wound up somewhere else. And he's on. Good afternoon, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
We did a little recon on how to actually pronounce your name, and we were told Pondicio.
I was going to say, what'd you come up with? Because I can't come up with a consistent one myself.
Yeah,
I know the feeling.
Actually, if I really read my note, it says Pondicio.
Yeah, I tend to use Pondicio. If I were a good paisan, I'd probably say Pondicio, but I guess I'm not a good paisan.
Okay, I started a good paisan and then I changed. All right, well, we just wanted to, you know, actually get it right one time, and then we'll just call you Robert from here on out.
That'll do.
So you have Aaron and Bill, and we have Bob, our engineer, so you know who you're actually speaking with, since this was kind of an on-the-fly thing. Thank you for being available, actually.
My pleasure.
And so I don't know where you want to start with all this.
Oh, my goodness.
It's totally up to you. No pressure.
Well, in terms of Common Core?
Well, yeah. You want to tell us anything about how you got there, or did we sort of hit the highlights in your...
Yeah, how's that Common Core working out for you?
Unfortunately, I missed the intro to the segment, so I'm not sure what you already what you've already said. But Common Core, as you probably know, is about 5 years old, depending on where you are in the country. It is an attempt to set a uniform set of standards from state to state, where until now we've had 50 different states, 50 different standards, as it were, which there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, obviously, we have a strong tradition in this country, appropriately so, of local control of education. The problem was, and forgive me if this is a bit wonky, the history is important here. Under No Child Left Behind back in 2001, that law did two things, one of them very good, one of them not so good, or at least perhaps unintended. It set the bar that saying, every state must move an increasing number of kids in the state towards proficiency. But what it did, I would argue incorrectly, was it let each state set its own bar for proficiency. Now, it doesn't take a genius to realize that if you put somebody, no matter what walk of life they're in charge of setting their own standards or their own level of job performance, they're going to set it as low as possible. So that's kind of what we had in many states.
That's kind of why they ultimately termed it race to the bottom?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say race to the bottom is kind of what it turned out.
Well, it leaves room for improvement.
A different way to put it is what Mike Petrilli and I call the Lake Wobegon effect, where, all the children are above average all of a sudden. So, and you would
exactly.
See this, and again, at the risk of being too wonky, there is a national assessment called NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, and it hasn't really moved that much in the last 40 years or so. and I'm painting with a broad brush, but roughly it shows that about one-third of kids read and do math, at a proficient level, what we would call, say, college and career ready. But in many states, you'd see 70, 80, 90% of kids being rated as proficient on state's own exams. So clearly there is acres and acres of daylight between what we knew to be true and what states were reporting to kids and families. And I don't want to be too harsh about it, but basically you're lying to kids, you're lying to families, you're lying to taxpayers about your academic performance. So whether you love Common Core or not, that should not go on. And Common Core, among its other features, was really intended to try to set more of a common standard to kind of get us out of that kind of gamesmanship that's been going on for the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, wasn't that the whole point of Common Core? Was all kids would be, have access to the same education in all states?
Yes and no. I mean, it's important to define our terms. I think a lot of the political controversy around Common Core has been based on that assumption that it's setting, not just a single set of standards, but something like a national curriculum, and that is not the case. The analogy that I always use, and frankly I get mystified sometimes as to why people get so hot and bothered about something as dry and tedious as academic standards, I often compare them to, say, auto safety standards or building codes. No matter, in most cities in this country, I'm sure just about all of them, there is a building code. If you're going to do new construction for a living, you have to build it in a certain way to make sure that it's fire safe, to code electrically, etc. That said, architects, not every single building in your town looks exactly the same because of building codes. So there's this idea that Common Core means every single kid will learn every single thing at the exact same way, at the exact same time, all across America on the same day. That is just not true. It sets a standard or a set of standards for teachers and schools to meet, but how schools and teachers meet those standards is strictly up to those local schools and teachers.
And to get into college, now I don't know if this has changed, but I think they weigh pretty heavily on SATs, which are a national standard. Is that correct?
Yes and no. This kind of hits me where I live. I've got a daughter who's a high school senior who's in the thick of this. So I've learned more about this than I wish I knew firsthand. Not every school in the country accepts SATs, for example, or the ACT, the most close competitor to it. There's an increasing movement in colleges to be test optional, as they say, so you don't need any entrance exam. But I mean, your point is well taken. I mean, we're somewhat used to kids, regardless of where they live, taking a single test to get something, in this case, college admissions.
Right.
Under Common Core, there's not a single test. There are two, broadly speaking, major test consortia, one called PARC, the other called Smarter Balance. Smarter Balance is by far the larger of the two. We have started to see in many states some of the results from last year's Smarter Balance tests come out. The PARC results, I believe, are coming out in a few weeks. As expected, those tests, which are geared to these higher standards, show a much lower level of proficiency compared to where states were reporting proficiency before. So, that's been a little bit of a cold shower for a lot of parents who were used to perhaps their kid, as I joked before, being above average, where all the children were above average. Mm-hmm. So, it's a sobering moment in our educational history, but I would argue it's somewhat important to be clear-eyed about where kids actually stand. To me, a very good measure of where kids do actually stand, you can look at this in your own community, but in many places in this country, it's not uncommon for kids to graduate from high school essentially on grade level and then go to college, and particularly community college, and need remedial education. So clearly something is wrong there. Like if you graduate from high school and you're basically being validated, this is where you're supposed to be, and then you show up on a college campus and they say, sorry kid, you need all these extra things, clearly those two pieces of our educational system are not speaking to one another very well. And worse, when children end up in remedial education at the college level, the odds that they will stick around and take the degree just dramatically drop. So I keep saying this, but whether you like Common Core or don't like Common Core, there are these certain structural issues here, these kind of disconnects between the K-12 system, higher education, and job readiness, that we have to close those gaps unless we want to continue to fail just large numbers of kids.
And how can we tell that that's – are we at a point yet where we can see that that's working or not working?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, this part of this is you know, I'm just being clear-eyed about this, and I'm a former teacher. I still teach one day a week. So anybody who suggests to you that you can set higher standards on day one and then on day two suddenly everything will be well, just has never been inside of the classroom. It is baby simple to set new standards. We've never had a difficult time in this country writing standards. What we've had a difficult time doing is meeting those standards. So it's, you know, it's a starting line, I would argue, Common Core, but it is by no means a finish line. It is going to take us, you know, several years, maybe many years, to raise the majority of American school kids to these higher standards.
So is it more or less just a crapshoot at this point where your kid graduates from college or graduates from high school, you think it's a good school, he gets good grades, and then heads for college and finds out he's not? I mean, how do you protect yourself?
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, I would argue that's setting higher standards, setting uniform standards, and being able to make comparisons across schools, districts, and states is step one to fixing this. And, you know, let me give you an example. I referred to this test earlier called NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. It's often called the nation's report card, and it's basically been the same test for several decades now. And if, well, let's just take 17-year-olds. NAEP is given basically three times, when you're 9, when you're 13, when you're 17. Now, not every kid takes NAEP. So think of it like a presidential poll, where a statistically representative sample of kids take that test. So then you can begin to compare. Now, and for example, we know that the Massachusetts education system has been one of the nation's highest performing for many, many years now. So on the one hand, you can look at it and say, well, you know, we know that Massachusetts is doing well, so we should do what Massachusetts does. That's fine, except the problem is, I think, when not every kid takes that test, that kind of data is just not persuasive to families. So you might have the circumstance, say you're in, you know, Alabama or Mississippi, a very low-performing state, you might look at that state data on NAEP and say, well, look, it's too bad that Alabama is so weak and Mississippi is so weak, but hey, my kid's doing great and my kid's school is great. So when everybody takes the same test, or, you know, the one or two of the same tests, then suddenly there's no place to hide anymore. You're not going to get that phenomenon where you say, you know, my kid's school is great, my kid's teacher is great, because you can make comparisons. Every single kid is taking the test. So it's much more like the SAT, for example, where, you know, if you get a 1900, then you know you're in, say, the 90th percentile. If you get a 1200, you know something's gone wrong.
Sure.
So in order to get parents, I think, really more clear-eyed and active in assessing where their kids and where their kids' schools stand, if Common Core does nothing else, I think this kind of visibility, this clarity around the data should help immeasurably.
Well, I think, you know, the apples-to-apples idea does have value, because you do hear all different places in the country and people have a tendency to, I mean, it affects a lot of things when your schools are rated as high-performing and low-performing. I mean, it actually hurts property value, so it has a lot of ripple effect.
Right. I think Americans have always had the same relationship with their schools that they have with Congress. You know, everybody says, oh, I hate Congress, but I love my congressmen. And I think most Americans will agree that, look, American education is not doing what it's supposed to do, but my kid's school and my kid's teacher are great. The only way, and maybe that's true, let's hope it's true, but unless you're looking at the same kind of data across the system nationwide, it's really hard to know that that's the case.
Yeah, the comparison isn't really accurately being made. We need to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with Robert Pondicio. We're talking about Common Core this morning, and we'll be chatting about some other stuff in the second hour. So we've got two different things going on today. You can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us.
Body and soul, then it's just your body, then they go. You're listening to We the People on AM 1460 KCNR. The phone number to call if you'd like to chime in is 530-605-4567.
The sound of a delicious wine. The sound of community awareness in the fight against breast cancer. Join KCNR and Westside Wine on October 15th for Think Pink Day. Stop by between 5 and 7 p.m. at Westside Wines, located at 1872 Buenaventura Boulevard, where Linda Bott will be our celebrity host, pouring glasses of rosé to benefit our local Think Pink organization. Bottles of rosé will be 30% off, and a percentage of all the sales that night will be donated to Think Pink. Come join us, a great local business, and support this amazing cause. You can help us spread the word about the importance of early detection. Save the date, October 15th. For more information, call Westside Wines at 941-1890.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. Centrally located in Memphis, Tennessee, GI Pathology delivers results to its nationwide client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to gipath.com for more information.
For 45 years, the Reading Civic Auditorium has been an important resource in the North State for entertainment, fundraising events, trade shows, and conferences. In the past 3 years, over $1 million have been put back into this iconic structure. We invite you to be a part of the Civic's revitalization by becoming a member. We think you'll love the benefits, and your support will help to sustain its revitalization and strong community connection. Visit ReadingCivic.com or the box office to become a Reading Civic member.
Uncle Bob, where did Mount Shasta spring water come from? Well, you see, we get wrung out of the clouds as we pass over the top of Mount Shasta. Then we become part of huge glaciers. Then we flow through miles of volcanic rocks. Then we pop out of a spring at the base of Mount Shasta. Uncle Bob, where did I come from? You'll have to ask your parents about that one.
Pure and simple, naturally the best. Mount Shasta spring water.
For free delivery and setup, call 1-800-922-6227. Or go to MountShastaSpringWater.com.
KCNR, 1460 AM. If we're not talking about it, it's probably not important. KCNR, 1460 AM.
Bob Fragger tries to put me down and says his school is great. I tell him right away, now what's the matter, buddy? Ain't you heard of my school? It's number one in the state.
Hey, take it away.
Go back to your school.
I got this topic, Bob. That's a good one. Welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And we will have the archive posted by 2:30-ish, so about half hour after the show. And the commercial-free archive will go up a little bit later today. We are speaking with Robert Pondicio, and Bill's got a question.
Oh, you're going to just go right to me?
Yeah, we're talking about Common Core testing, basically, today.
Yeah, it's the show's more about the testing aspect of Common Core, not so much the content, which has always been a big controversy. You spoke earlier about some schools are rated higher than others, or some states are rated higher. If a parent wanted to go to the highest rated state, I mean, do you have those numbers? What states are really doing well and which ones aren't?
Oh, yikes. That's hard. It's hard to make broad generalizations. I mean, Massachusetts...
Well, it's been five years, so I would think they'd have some numbers in by now on...
But not everybody's... People started...
You're referring to Common Core. I don't want to be, you know, overly fussy about this, but I think, you know, think of Common Core like kind of the egg in the python, so to speak. It's going to take some time before the school systems get to digest that, because we're asking a lot more suddenly of schools both on math and reading. And in some cases, we're expecting, you know, much higher level performance, some shifts in the way teachers teach, for example. So it'd be really premature, I think, to say who are kind of the winners and losers in terms of Common Core. And I got to be honest, that kind of thinking just kind of distracts me a little bit, because if there's anything that I think I'm right about here, it's that we expect you know, instant gratification from schools, and that's just maybe asking too much. And then there's a big difference between math and reading, for example. I mean, math, broadly speaking, is a kind of a school-based subject. Most of the math that you learn in school, so you're probably going to see some movement in math under Common Core a lot faster than you'll see it in reading or literacy. The way I like to describe this is math is kind of hierarchical, and I should caution that I'm painting with a broad brush. People who are serious about math will tell you I'm somewhat wrong about this, but broadly speaking, math is kind of a hierarchical subject, meaning, you know, first you learn to count, then you learn to add and subtract and multiply and divide, then percents, ratios, decimals. There tends to be a progression of the way you learn math. Language is very, very different. If math is hierarchical, language is cumulative, and what I mean by that is just about every input that a child has, you know, from the moment they come home from the hospital builds knowledge, builds vocabulary, builds language proficiency. I mean, if you think about it, you know, most every single child comes to school at age 4 for the first time knowing some words, knowing how to speak, speaking and listening, so to speak. They may not be reading and writing quite yet, but they've got some language. And that language is more sophisticated than, say, their math ability. You know, if a kid comes to kindergarten already counting to 20, for example, then they're ahead of the game. So this is a long way of saying that it's a lot harder for schools to move the needle on reading and writing than it is in math, for example. So I'm just being very, very cautious here in not expecting Common Core or any set of standards to show dramatic improvement quickly.
Well, we also have the input of tons and tons of illegal immigrants that have come across the border that are all being assimilated into the schools, and that's got to have a huge effect.
Probably going to drag the numbers down, but you've only got 4 years
of language,
basically, to get these kids ready for college. Once they graduate as a senior and head for college, that's where the proof is of pudding right there. Did they pick up the skills they needed in that 4 year period of time, or didn't they?
Referring to high school only. I tend to look at education as kind of a
K-12
system. So starting from age 4 to, say, age 17, so
okay.
It's really more like 13 years.
Okay.
Sure, but like in your article, you had said that a third of the students are on track for college in California, in the state of California.
Yeah, and that's in the aggregate, because you also have to consider that in more affluent communities, that number is going to be higher. In
Absolutely.
Lower income communities, it's going to be lower. But it in the aggregate, roughly 30%, one third.
Yeah, see, and that actually, when you consider that, because we're the equivalent of, in some cases, you know, three states on the East Coast, you know, just size-wise.
Oh, absolutely. Maybe even more, depending on which state.
True.
But, you know, just to continue what I was saying before, you know, because language is a very, very slow-growing plant, if you are talking about kids who grow up in homes with uneducated parents, maybe English is a second language, it's going to be a lot harder still for schools to have an impact on those kids than it would in, say, an affluent community in Silicon Valley or Los Angeles, for example. That's you always have to be cautious. Whenever you're talking about education as a broad matter, it's very, very hard to make these comparisons.
So what are we looking at? 20 years down the road to see if Common Core was a viable alternative to our traditional teaching, or
yeah,
is it going to be something
that's
fluid?
I'm tempted to say yes, that sounds about right. I also realize that's probably politically unfeasible. If schools are not showing at least some promising growth in, say, 3 to 5 years, then there's going to be trouble. I like to joke that education is not above the political fray; it is the fray. so, you know, I'm on the one hand, I'm always the guy who is cautioning patients, and let's pick something and stick with it. On the other hand, you know, you got to live in the real world, and in the real world, you can only say be patient so long before parents and taxpayers are going to say, no, this isn't working. You know, the other thing, too, to consider is that, you know, and you know this very, very well in California, you know, we've got 3.7 million teachers in classrooms in this country. If you have 3.7 million of anybody, there's going to be a range of talent, you know, from absolute superstars who all of us would be thrilled to have our kids in their class, you know, to some people who might you know, consider doing other things for a living. So we're this is a very, very heavy lift. We're asking an awful lot of schools and teachers, and, you know, some schools and teachers will rise to the challenge, some may not. But another effect that Common Core, I think, will have is it will it'll tell us some things about our school system and where they stand. You're in California, so you remember the UCLA coach John Wooden, who memorably said that sports does not build character; it reveals it. I've come around to thinking the same thing is true of Common Core. It's not necessarily going to build proficiency. Hopefully, it will. But it's going to reveal a lot about our school system, and you know the one caveat I guess I want to make is that there's not one single thing that you can do in American education that just pull this lever and everything will be well. I mean, yes, you need higher standards, but again, it's easy to set higher standards. It's very, very hard to reach them, but this kind of clarity that will come from those higher standards and the test results, I think, is an important first step.
Yeah, and does any of this connect up with funding, or what other aspects have you looked at?
Is funding in what way? You mean federal funding?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have districts that are, I mean, out here, we've been in the West, you have rural schools that were funded by resources, you know, the harvesting of timber and things like that. And since that's been sharply curtailed, a lot of those schools now are really, really struggling. Is there any correlation?
Yeah, I confess I'm not as familiar with the state funding formulas in California as in New York, where I live, and some other states. But the vast majority of funding for schools across this country, as a general rule, tends to come from state and local tax levies. There is a significant percentage, but it's not anywhere near the majority, to my knowledge, from the federal government. But one of the reasons that Common Core has become so politically controversial is because even though it was a state-led initiative where it was started by the National Governors Association and an organization called ACHIEVE, where states independently got together and tried to set a single set of standards, where it's gotten politically controversial is that the federal government, the Obama administration, and his Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, embraced Common Core and incentivized, and I'm making air quotes as I say the word incentivized, states to adopt Common Core, both for the so-called Race to the Top program. It was one of the bars the cost of admission, so to speak, to participate in that program, and also in the case of state waivers, under No Child Left Behind, if your kids were not reaching proficiency, you needed a waiver, and one of the conditions of the waivers became adopting Common Core. So this is what has caused a lot of people, especially on the political right, to say, you know, Common Core is national standard, it's being imposed upon us, etc. I'm not about to defend that, the politics of that. You know, I will very much defend higher standards and these particular standards. But very often when I'm asked to speak about this, the very first thing that gets thrown at you is, well, these are national standards, and you know, this is you know, politically wrong. And I don't disagree with that. I think we probably would have been better served if 12 or 15 states had done this well. And then 5 or 10 years from now, other states look and say, hey, that's going really well for those states. We want in. We want to do that, too. But you can't unring that bell. You know, the political situation happened. I just urge people to look at the standards themselves and not the politics surrounding them.
Sure. And it is kind of important because those are two very different discussions. We've had a lot of discussion on that other side. That's why I thought this was kind of an interesting
No, I'm quite sympathetic to that. I understand that. What's kind of interesting, however, is, and there have been a number of polls now about this, when you ask Americans, do you think that your child's school should have higher standards, they say yes. When you read them what the Common Core standards say, without calling it Common Core, they say, yes, that's what I want for my child. Then you ask, do you want Common Core, and they say no. So it's it is what they say in politics is what they call a tainted brand. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is.
It's got a bad name at this point. We need to take another really quick break. We're going to return here for more discussion on this because I've got more questions. Bill's over here. He's mulling things over. He's going to ask all his questions at the end, I can tell.
I'll be here.
All right. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
You're listening to We the People on Community Talk Radio for the North State, AM 1460, KCNR.
Jones's Fort, Redding's full-line gun shop, offers the largest selection of guns and gun accessories in the North State. We are Redding's full-line gun shop. Since 1969, we have been serving the Redding area. We at Jones's Fort take pride in being able to offer you sound advice on all your gun questions. You'll always find a good selection of new and used guns at Jones's Fort. We'll help you find the gun that is perfect for you. Have a gun you no longer need? Bring it to us. We buy, trade, and consign. Informal appraisals are given free at no charge. No gun shop is complete without expert gunsmiths. We have 4 full-time gunsmiths who can service all types of firearms. In our full machine shop, we can enhance the performance of your favorite gun or build you a custom gun to meet your needs. Marshal Dave Jones II heads up our Firearm Institute, where we do California concealed weapon classes, Utah classes, and hunter education classes. Come see us at Jones's Fort.
Hi, Linda Bott here from KCNR.
And Nathan Parmalee from Redding's own Civic Auditorium.
The Redding Civic is bringing the excitement to its newly updated theater. The 2015-2016 season promises to wow you and include a 15% savings option when you purchase tickets to 3 or more shows.
So start your holiday season with the exquisite artistry of Moscow Ballet's Great Russian Nutcracker. Enjoy heartfelt Christmas classics with the Oak Ridge Boys Christmas Show and take in the stunning debut of the Civic's very own production of Christmas Carol, A Love Story.
2016 kicks off with the pop culture phenomenon of Flashdance the Musical.
The devilishly funny production of C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters.
The wildly theatrical show Blue Man Group and the fun family experience of Chris Parandi's Stunt Dog Experience.
For tickets and more, visit RedingCivic.com or the Redding Civic box office.
See you at the show!
KCNR, 1460 AM, the most local programming in Northern California.
You've been telling me you're a genius since you were 17. In all the time I've known you, I still don't know what you mean. The weekend at the college didn't turn out like you planned. The things that pass for knowledge I can't understand. Are you reeling in the years? Stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears?
You are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with Robert Pondicio, and we're chatting about Common Core, but we're not talking about it the way we have previously done. We're not looking at how it works and what they teach and what the curriculum looks like. We're looking more at what the results could be, will be, should be. So, Robert, you have all different places in the country that have started this. We're having trouble asking you what we want to ask you because we can't figure out how to phrase it. I think what we've decided is Are you, I know you can't say how the, you know, how the ultimate testing is turning out because, like, California just started this, what, last year? And in New York, they started this 5 years ago, is that?
I think most of the states that have been, that have adopted Common Core are, you know, within the same range of their implementation. They're mostly about 5 years in. What is new is the testing. So, you know, there has been a fairly long runway for schools across the country to get used to implementing Common Core. And then last spring, for most of the country, was the first year that you saw Common Core aligned tests. That was certainly true in California. I think New York was 1 year ahead. But just about most every state in the country, the spring of 2015 was the first time that students in grades 3 through 8 and usually in the 11th grade took so-called Common Core tests, either the Smarter Balance test or the PARC assessment or, you know, one or two others. That's what's new here. So the whole country is more or less in the same place in terms of adoption implementation. It's only now that we're starting to see the test results. And I think, and again, I'm painting with a broad brush. I keep saying that because you really do have to look district by district, school by school. But I would say that I was, I don't want to say pleasantly surprised, because if you have more than half of kids, as we do in this country, not where they need to be in terms of math and reading proficiency, that is not good news. But it's not as bad as I expected. Where if I was expecting, say, 30 to 35% of kids at or above grade level, we're seeing more like 40 to 50%, which, again, you know, not good news, but not the real train wreck that I think some of us were expecting to see.
Yeah, because I think right now, or in the past, very recent past, our schools are ranked very low compared to around the world. Our education system has really failed our kids. So we really don't have anywhere to go but up. And with Common Core, now that a lot of these places have been in it for 5 years and the testing is starting to come in, when do you think we'll have a feel for whether or not we're starting to gain ground?
Well, I mean, hopefully you'll see progress year by year. I don't want to be glib about this, but I sometimes think that when you work in a school, as I do, your take on test scores is something like the stages of grief. You know, you go through the denial and acceptance phase, so to speak. So I think too many schools would look at Common Core and say, oh, well, we're already doing that. And then you get the test results, and where you're used to, say, you know, depending on where you are in this country, 70 or 80% of your kids passing, when suddenly it's 30 to 40% of the kids, there's a bit of a gut check moment there, right? And you say, oh, maybe we're not doing what we need to do to get kids prepared. So I think you have to account for a little bit of that as well. But in a perfect world, and nobody ever said that K-12 education was that, in an ideal world, you'll see teachers and schools looking at these results and making some good choices, you know, about the way they teach, about curriculum. At the risk of beating a dead horse, standards is one element of school improvement. I've got a good friend who sometimes says, there are no silver bullets in education, but there might be silver buckshot. And what he means by that is that you've got to get a whole lot of things moving quickly in one direction. You know, resources, teacher quality, curriculum, parental support, on and on and on. There's anybody who says, you know, fix this one thing and all will be well, I think hasn't spent an awful lot of time in schools. But I think this work, and it is, you know, patient, deliberate work that takes many years, starts by setting higher standards and then giving good, clear-eyed tests that are, you know, benchmarked against those higher standards. So it's, you know, we didn't get into this situation overnight. If you look at the decline in American education, it has been a slow erosion over decades. So I don't think that we can reverse it overnight. But I think hopefully we'll start to see at least some incremental improvement year after year after year.
Yeah, the largest, by far, the largest block of complaints seems to be about the math.
Sure. Yeah, and that's, you know, again, I hate to get into arguments with parents who are rightly concerned when they see things coming home in their child's backpack, and then they get told, well, that's Common Core. I always challenge them, or if here's what I say to parents. If something comes home in your child's backpack, it's, you know, math assignments or a reading assignment, and you think, hey, this is ridiculous. Why is this happening in my school? Do not accept the answer from a teacher or a school or a district. Well, we have no choice. That's Common Core. The very next question would be, show me where it says in Common Core that you have to teach this book, that you have to use this textbook, that you have to use this math assignment. I can't emphasize this point more strongly. Common Core is not a curriculum. It is a set of standards. So it would be no different than a car dealer saying, look, I have no choice. I have to sell you this particular car because auto safety standards say this is the only car for you. It just doesn't work that way. Standards like building codes, like food safety, handling procedures, like auto safety standards, they are guidelines for manufacturers. They do not tell teachers what to teach. They do not tell schools what to assign. If I'm wrong about this, show me an example. But invariably, whenever somebody shows me a silly math assignment and say that's Common Core, it just never turns out that way. In fact, I was on the John Stossel show a few months ago on Fox, and one of the producers was out on Sixth Avenue here in New York City trying to get passersby to solve a ridiculous math problem. And I recognized it instantly. It was from my everyday math textbook that I used to use in fifth grade in the South Bronx in the year 2002, long before there was a Common Core. So, I don't want to, get into an argument about this, but in too many instances, a lot of us who've been complaining about, bad curricula, whether it's in math or reading or whatnot, who've been fighting this fight for a very long time, and people get upset about this stuff now, I'm tempted to just kind of throw up my hands and say, where have you been? You know, we've been complaining about this for years, and now you think it's Common Core. This has been what's been going on in schools for a long time.
Interesting. So taking out, taking out Shakespeare and some of those things I was a high school English teacher, and so the idea that they're taking some of that out, that's not mandated by Common Core?
Well, it's funny, actually. Common Core, I'm much more of a literacy guy than a math guy, but on the literacy side, very few specific works of literature are cited. The only two that I can think of off the top of my head are at least one work of Shakespeare and the foundational documents, things like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. There are suggested reading lists, but in terms of mandated texts under Common Core, the only specific author that is mentioned to my knowledge is Shakespeare, and the only specific genre, as it were, is foundational documents. And I'm hard-pressed to think that anybody would object to their kids learning Shakespeare or the Declaration.
See, it's interesting. I think that some of the school systems are using Common Core as a smokescreen, I guess.
Want to criticize, but I do think there's a little bit of blaming the messenger here. And this is what I was joking about, calling it the John Wooden effect, where it reveals a lot about our school system, as opposed to mandating it.
So how does you were talking about standards? And I don't know if this really even matters, but how do the Common Core standards compare to, say, standards in some of the other Western countries?
I think that was the starting line. The hope is that they will begin to more resemble, if not the letter of it, obviously, we're not Germany, we're not Finland, but the level of it. This is where, guys like me get concerned about our international standing. I don't think these things have ever been persuasive to parents. But if you look at K-12 as a kind of strategic interest of this country, it doesn't matter what you're looking at, whether it's math or reading or science, we end up, in the middle to the bottom of the pack against nations that we are competing against economically, the countries that our children will compete with, so to speak, for jobs and economic opportunity in the future. On the one hand, nobody sends their kid to school to become an economic actor, so to speak. But you have to be concerned about this. I mean, we have a country of 320 million people. We need to, be economically competitive to maintain our standard of living. Again, that's not necessarily persuasive to individual parents, but it certainly is a compelling national interest, and it's a little bit terrifying. When you see, for example, and I'm just making this up, I don't have the data in front of me, that, we're not doing as well in science and math as, say, Lithuania, the country that put a man on the moon and built the Apple computer is trailing some surprising countries on strategic things like math and science. And again, whether you like Common Core or hate Common Core, surely we can all agree that we can do better than that.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, we need to take our very last break. When we come back, do you want to talk a little bit about the Fordham Institute?
Sure, happy to.
Because we don't know anything about it, and we're assuming that most of our listeners don't either. So since you're involved with that, any of the things that you're involved with that you could point people to more information, maybe that'd be a nice way to end up our hour here. We're speaking with Robert Pondizio here on Common Core and all those things. He's coming to us from New York. Isn't that fun? And on Monday, the nice folks in Philadelphia will get to hear you, so that's kind of nice. They'll know exactly what you're talking about. We'll be right back. Biology. Don't know much about science books. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're tuned to AM 1460 KCNR, and you're listening to We the People. Our phone number is 605. Check that. 530-605-4567.
Everyone wants to be a hero. It's part of our DNA. Join One Safe Place as we honor local heroes, survivors, coaches, law enforcement, tribal leaders, military, and parents. Be a Hero to Your Children is a One Safe Place benefit dinner to help support a community affected by family violence. With special keynote speaker, consultant to the NBA, MLB, NFL, educator and activist, TED Talks Tony Porter. Be a Hero to Your Children benefit dinner is on Thursday, October 22nd at the Wind River Resort and Casino Event Center. To purchase your hosted table now, before they're all gone, call One Safe Place at 244-0118, extension 206. Sponsored in part by Region 3 Safe Program and Shasta Regional Medical Center. And remember, not all heroes wear capes.
Kyle DeFore from Mighty Fine Foods in Bella Vista here. We'd like to thank our community for a great summer season and invite everyone to come enjoy our newly expanded fall beer selection. Bake and bake pizzas, daily deli specials under $5, and fresh-made breakfast every day. Our family has been part of Shasta County since the 1930s, and we're proud to advertise our local business on local radio. Come shop with your friends and neighbors at Mighty Fine Foods at the corner of 299 and Deschutes in beautiful Bella Vista.
Have you found yourself stranded with a dead battery and need a jump? Instead of calling that expensive tow truck, call Redding Yellow Cab and they'll do it for only $20. Running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the year, Redding Yellow Cab will cater to the needs of your parents, seniors, or children who need to travel throughout the city and county no matter the hour. Call Redding Yellow Cab and they'll do your shopping, give rides to the hospital, airport, hotel, and many other destinations. Call them at 222-1234.
National news with a local view. KCNR, 1460 AM.
Well, we can't salute ya. Can't find a flag. If that don't suit ya, that's a drag. Scoop out for summer. Scoop out forever. Scoop and run.
Welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We air in California live on Sundays from noon to 2 here at KCNR 1460 AM. And we are repeated Mondays in Philadelphia and New Jersey on WNJC 1360 AM. So you can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with Robert Pondizio, and he's a senior fellow at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Tell us about that. We don't know anything about them.
I'm fairly new to this world. My point of entry into the world of education was as a classroom teacher for several years in the South Bronx, and then working for an organization called the Core Knowledge Foundation, founded by E.D. Hirsch, who some of your listeners may remember, wrote a terrific book 30 years ago called Cultural Literacy. But Fordham is what they call in Washington a think tank. So, you know, we earnestly pull on our chins about, you know, important issues around education. I mean, I'm being arch and ironic, but, you know, our particular issues are things like choice, school choice, parental choice, charters, standards, for example. We have been longtime advocates of higher standards, so it is not much of a surprise that we are in favor of Common Core, because that's some of the work that we've done over the years to encourage American education to raise its standards. That's the broad bucket of work that we do, is, you know, what is broadly defined as education reform. My own particular interest, this makes me a little bit of an odd duck at a place like Fordham. I'm a lot more in, where all of those things like choice and charters, teacher quality, etc., those are what you might think of as structural reforms. It's about changing the way schools are organized and run, or the way parents and students access education. My interests tend to be more around the instructional side, so I'm very interested in curriculum and teaching. This is not to say that I don't like charters and choice. I do quite a lot. I think it's a lot easier to improve the product of education in a choice-friendly environment than, say, a charter school environment. But there's nothing about the work that I'm interested in on literacy and curriculum that you could not apply both just as easily to a charter school or a public school.
Hmm. Interesting, because you spent 20 years in journalism and then suddenly became a fifth-grade teacher, so...
Yeah, I often have to explain.
We're just sort of
that.
Curious about that little turn there.
Sure. I describe it as a mid-career impulse purchase. There's a program here in New York City called the New York City Teaching Fellows, which is specifically designed. A lot of your listeners are probably familiar with Teach for America, where, you know, bright, shiny college undergraduates from some of our top universities end up teaching in the inner cities for 2 years, make a 2-year commitment. Think of that only for mid-career professionals. So I had been 20 years in journalism and saw teaching as a 2-year mid-career public service stint. Ended up teaching at literally the lowest performing school in the lowest performing district in New York City, and assumed that I would do that for 2 years and then, you know, go back to the news business. But like a lot of people, I found that once you get into that world and start to grapple with all the work that needs to be done, it's very, very hard to walk away from that.
That's kind of fun. And then you're... The charter schools in Harlem, I don't know about those, Democracy Prep public schools. So was that already formed, or did you get to...
Yeah, Democracy Prep started, I believe, in 2006. It's a big claim to fame, at least in our part of the world, is that we really put a special premium on civic education. And I've written a lot about this over the years as well. Broadly speaking, if you challenge you, ask a parent, you know, why do you send your kid to school, and they will invariably name some kind of private end. Well, so my kid could go to college, so my kid could get a good job, so my kid could, you know, do a little bit better than I did. That's all fine and laudable. But if you look at the history of public education, I always joke that Horace Mann probably went to his grave never having once uttered the phrase college and career ready. We had a different vision for public schools 150 years ago, and it was preparation for citizenship. A republic was kind of an odd bargain, historically speaking, 200 years ago. You know, they tended to end not well. So
sure.
Our founders and early education thinkers, people like Horace Mann, envisioned public education as a necessary component to ensure that the average American, you know, knew enough to participate in our democracy. We have gotten away from that vision of schooling, I would argue.
No.
We're
shocked.
Yeah, no. It's, you know, so Democracy Prep really embraces that, and we right in our mission, we prepare kids for citizenship as much as college and career.
Oh, my gosh, that's fantastic. Would that we could put that into some sort of a shot.
Oh, I'm trying. That's another issue I work on at Fordham. I also do a weekly column at U.S. News, which your listeners can take a look at. But I tend to write mostly about literacy and civic education. Those are my two drums that I tend to bang on the loudest.
That's great, because, you know, honestly, the education should... there are people who don't... I mean, right now, you know, you hear all the time one real common thing. You hear that the House of Representatives has the power of the purse. But people don't realize that the way you exercise that is they originate all spending, but it still has to go through the Senate, still has to be signed by the president. I mean, we have grown-up people who think that the House can act unilaterally. It's like they are not the fourth branch of government.
I teach a senior seminar to the seniors of Democracy Prep, the 12th graders, and I insist that they read the newspaper. I insist they follow current events because there's not a week that goes by where I cannot find a live constitutional issue in the news. It never fails to talk about and debate about. So, and a lot
it
of
is
times,
a, it is a fairly target rich environment, isn't it?
It's a very rich vein of lore. It never runs out.
Well, we appreciate you coming on with us this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure. This has been fun.
Yeah, super fun, and there's obviously a tremendous amount to talk about. Please keep us in mind and let us know. We don't always follow everybody's everything, but if you have something fun that you think people need to know about, reach out to us if you would.
I certainly will. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
All right, and so for our second hour here, we're going to move, sort of good segue there, actually, because we're going to move to Michael Connolly, who's a U.S. Army veteran, a constitutional attorney, and the executive director of the United States Justice Foundation. So, Robert Pundicio, thank you so much. We appreciate it. And you can find all that online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Oh, yeah.
KCNR, Chester Reddick.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Gordon Griffin. President Obama will hold a formal meeting Tuesday with Cuban President Raul Castro on the sidelines of the annual UN General Assembly. It will be the second face-to-face meeting between President Obama and Castro since the U.S. and Cuba restored diplomatic relations late last year. Tomorrow, President Obama meets with Russian President Vladimir Putin. House Speaker John Boehner says that there won't be a government shutdown when funding expires this week.
The Senate is expected to pass a continuing resolution next week. The House will take up the Senate bill.
A special committee will be set up to investigate Planned Parenthood. Conservatives have been pushing to add a provision to fund Planned Parenthood to the government funding bill. Boehner appeared this morning on CBS's Face the Nation. President Obama promising to reach out to the next Speaker of the House. We get details now from White House correspondent Greg Clugston.
After praising outgoing Speaker John Boehner as a good man and a patriot on Friday, the president promised to reach out immediately to the next speaker. He said he hopes Boehner's successor is open to compromise.
When you have a democracy, compromise is necessary. And I think Speaker Boehner sometimes had difficulty persuading members of his caucus that.
Because of that, the president said he didn't expect a major shift in Republican politics. Greg Clugston, the White House.
An Afghan official says Islamic State gunmen have attacked checkpoints near the Pakistan border, killing three police officers and wounding eight. The official says it's the group's first attack on security forces in the province. The French president jolted the final day of a major UN summit by announcing his country's first airstrikes in Syria. Francois Hollande told reporters at the UN that six French jet fighters have destroyed an Islamic State training camp in eastern Syria. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Hey everyone, Proactive has a special offer for our listeners. Stay tuned for a 100% risk-free offer that includes a free giveaway and free shipping. Do you have acne or even the occasional breakout? With prescription-grade Proactive, your acne can heal and you can prevent future breakouts. Want to try Proactive? They're letting everyone try Proactive 100% risk-free. Plus, they're giving away a free deep cleansing face brush and free shipping when you call right now. 1-800-240-7992. You heard right. A risk-free trial of Proactive. Proactive, a free deep cleansing brush and free shipping. Take it from me, Proactive really works. So here's the deal again for our listeners. For $19.95, you'll get prescription-grade Proactive, plus a rotating deep cleansing brush valued at $45. Totally free and free shipping. You're guaranteed to get clear and stay clear, or you get your money back. Call now, 1-800-240-7992. That's 1-800-240-7992. One more time, ready? 800-240-7992.
Powerful words from Pope Francis to U.S. bishops after a meeting with victims of clergy sex abuse.
Dios llora.
God weeps.
Los crímenes y pecados de los abusos sexuales a menores.
Sexual abuse
of children. En secreto por
These cannot be maintained in secret.
The Pope is in Philadelphia today where he is now holding a mass. South Dakota's decade-old experiment in reducing drunken driving is now gaining momentum nationwide. Offenders are required to be tested for alcohol twice a day every day. Those who pass the test stay out of jail. Those who fail are immediately jailed. 12 hours for the first offense, 24 hours for the second.
A third failure brings incarceration. North Dakota and Montana have started similar monitoring systems, and at least five more states are running or planning pilot programs. News and analysis at townhall.com. I'm Gordon Griffin. A man with an apparent case of arachnophobia caused a fire at a suburban Detroit gas pump.
The man was getting ready to fill up at a convenience store gas pump when he was scared by a spider near the gas cap, so he decided to kill the bug using his cigarette lighter. But the flames started a fire that quickly engulfed the gas pump. The clerk in the store kept her calm to hit the emergency auto stop button, then call the fire department. In the meantime, the man used a fire extinguisher to put out the fire before firemen arrived. He was not injured, and it appears car was not damaged, but the gasoline pump was totally destroyed. Rhonda Rockstra reporting.
There are media reports in Germany that Volkswagen had a years-old warning against the trickery that it used to defeat emissions tests on diesel vehicles. The automaker admitted last week that it used special software to fool U.S. test. German Weekly reports say that the BMW internal investigation found a 2000 letter from a parts supplier warning against the use. More on these stories at townhall.com.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. We've got all our archives there for, what, last 5 years? We've been doing this 5 years, Bob? Yeah, 2010?
Four going on five.
Yeah, next month, I guess. Imagine that. It was a little lark that turned into 5 years.
Yeah, is it next month?
Yeah, October. I know
is
it was
it?
October.
Yeah.
Very odd. Anyway, tons of good information there. We are 2 hours here on the West Coast from noon to 2 on KCNR 1460 AM every Sunday, and you can join us online in the chat room with that if you go to the website. You can also the show is replayed again in Philadelphia and New Jersey, WNJC 1360 AM. So there you have it. I think that's all our gear. I'm Aaron Ryan. Co-host is...
Still kind of.
Just putting on his headset.
Still kind of.
And our engineer is Bob Martin. He's the one who comes up with all the great music. We get no credit for that. Bob's pushing all the buttons, and he's in charge of all the music, and he's awesome. So 5 years of thanks, Bob.
Well, thank you.
Makes our
even
show.
Though I wasn't here for the first year.
You're giving you 5 years of thanks. I don't remember who was here. And they don't work here anymore anyway, so forget them. How quickly we
actually,
kick people
I guess,
to the curb.
I guess I joined the show about 6 months into it,
yeah.
As I'm remembering now.
Well, yeah, it was pretty fun.
Yeah, I don't even remember the other guy.
I don't either. Who knows about him? Elizabeth was here for the first few years. You weren't here. I'm the only one who's been here. All right, onward. So our guest this second hour is Michael Connolly. We have about a million things to talk to him about. He's qualified to talk about all sorts of stuff. He's got a great biography. He's a U.S. Army veteran. Thank you for your service, by the way. And constitutional attorney. Thank you for your service there, too. And the executive director of the United States Justice Foundation. He currently lives in Dallas, Texas. My brothers are in Southlake, so we're all big fans of that area of Texas. Let's see. So I'm going to read this part because this is interesting. Michael received his Juris Doctorate from Louisiana State University in 1973, practiced law in Baton Rouge for 26 years, specializing in constitutional law, handled cases involving, ready, First Amendment, Second Amendment, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Ninth, and Tenth Amendments to the Constitution. So you've kind of been there and done that.
Pretty much covered it all.
That's pretty fun. And one part, I don't care when we cover it, but I would like to make sure you speak a little bit about the Second Amendment rights for veterans. I don't know if it was a case or if it's just a topic that you cover, but that's really very much in the news these days. And so at some point in our chat, we should do that. You also host a radio program. Bill's pointing out to me. I've got that on the website, too. All this is on there. So if you go to wethepeopleradio.us, you will find all of this. And it's americaswebradio.com. And let's see, Michael, your webpage is really easy, too, isn't it? I think it's michaelconnolly.com, right?
Well, actually, there's
I found
two webpages. USJF.net is the webpage for the United States Justice Foundation.
Right.
And then my webpage, where my blog is, is michaelconnolly.jigsy, J-I-G-S-Y, .com.
That's right. I knew there was more to it than that. But, yeah, I found all sorts of stuff. I was doing a little searching online, and you're sort of ubiquitous. All right, so where would you like to start?
Well, the veterans case that you mentioned are something that actually I've been working on for 2.5 years. We broke the story about 2.5 years ago. I wrote an article on my blog called Disarming America's Heroes because I've been contacted by some veterans who had received letters from the VA basically saying that because of your physical or mental disabilities, we are going to declare you incompetent to handle your own financial affairs, and we're going to appoint a fiduciary to represent you and handle your affairs. Well, the fiduciary program has been around for many, many years for elderly veterans who might be suffering from dementia and needed help paying their bills on time and that sort of thing. But then we looked at the letter more closely and found out from these veterans what they were being declared incompetent for, what the reasoning was. And we realized that this was much more far-reaching than just trying to help veterans with their finances. So the letter goes on to say, and I've got copies of these letters that have been sent out all over the country by VA regional offices, and the letter goes on to say, once we declare you incompetent, you can no longer own, possess, transport, or purchase firearms or ammunition. If you do, you're guilty of a felony under the Brady Act.
Yeah,
and so I started talking to veterans around the country, and they were telling me they were being declared incompetent because they had minor PTSD from being in combat, or they had sometimes suffered from depression from losing a buddy in combat. But they're also being declared incompetent, and I've got this in writing, being declared incompetent because they let their spouses pay the family bills. Or in the case of a veteran we're representing right here in Canton, by the way, recently we bought a ranch out in East Texas, so I'm not technically in Dallas anymore. I'm out in Canton, and I'm representing a veteran right here in Canton who has been declared incompetent on the grounds that he has his bills automatically paid out of his checking account every month.
Yikes. Oh my gosh. I'm incompetent, too.
Don't you have to be declared incompetent by a licensed doctor?
Well, that's just it. They're not being declared incompetent by doctors. Most of the time, these veterans have not even been examined by a psychiatrist or a psychologist, yet they're being declared incompetent. And this, in this particular case, this gentleman has never even seen a doctor who has talked to him about this.
So basically, bureaucrat's decided that he's incompetent, and they'll take it from here.
Well, that's what we've uncovered. I started getting contacted by some whistleblowers in the VA, and they told me that the way this is done is it's outside independent contractors with very little training and virtually no supervision. They're given the file of a veteran, including their medical records, which, of course, violates the privacy, the HIPAA Act.
Yep.
They're being given these records, and they're being told to declare this veteran incompetent. And then the veteran gets the letter, and the letter gives them 60 days in which to prove they're competent. Now, that in itself violates the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment.
How exactly do you do that?
It's really
hard.
I've dealt with that, too. Yeah.
But they put the burden of proof on the veteran,
sure.
Not on the government, where it should be. And so the veteran has to go out, and they've gone out and hired psychiatrists and, you know, had the psychiatrist write letters declaring them perfectly competent to handle their affairs, but it doesn't seem to matter. And then it gets worse, because once they are declared incompetent, and we have, through a Freedom of Information Act request and for a subsequent lawsuit against the VA, we obtained a copy of a memorandum between the VA and the FBI, where basically they agree, the FBI agrees that without adjudication, and this is what's required by law, under the National Instant Criminal Background Checklist, the so-called NICS list, you can be put on that list if you are a convicted felon, a known illegal drug user, or have been adjudicated to be mentally incompetent to the point of being a danger to yourself or others. The FBI is declaring all veterans who have been declared incompetent by the VA to fall under that latter category, mentally incompetent to the point of being a danger to yourself or others. They put them on the NICS list. There's virtually no way to get off that list, even if they win their appeals and get the incompetency ruling reversed. The FBI does no investigation themselves. We estimate there are 200,000 veterans on the list right now. And Senator Charles Grassley's committee is investigating this in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we're working with them. And they have determined that of the people on that list, the next list, under that category of being mentally ill, 99.3% of them are veterans.
Wow.
These veterans can't purchase firearms. They can't own firearms. Now their family members are being contacted by the VA and other federal agencies and being told, since you live with a veteran who's been declared incompetent, you can't own firearms either.
Well, gosh, that's a neat trick.
Yeah. They're also contacting veterans and putting them on the no-fly list.
Wow, this is starting to sound more than just a small thing here. It sounds a little bit like a conspiracy, doesn't it?
Well, we look at it this way. You've got 23 million veterans in this country, and I've got two sons currently on active duty in the military. We all took the same oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And we believe in that oath. That oath doesn't expire. It didn't expire when I left the active military or left the reserves. I'm still bound by that oath as far as I'm concerned. And most of the other veterans out there feel the same way. We're also trained to defend our country. And so we are a real and present danger. If we are armed, we're a real and present danger to anybody in this country who decides they want to declare this country a dictatorship, wants to abolish our constitutional republic. In Nazi Germany, one of the first things that Adolf Hitler did after he was elected chancellor was start to disarm the German population, beginning with the World War One veterans in Germany, because they had all taken a similar oath of office to what I took. So it's an outright move for gun control. And gun control over a group of people who are the least likely to be willing to voluntarily surrender their weapons, and the people that are most likely to be willing to fight to defend this country if necessary. And, you know, the horror stories go on and on, because we have veterans out there who are being told that if they appeal, and they do have a right to appeal, but if they appeal the decision declaring them incompetent, and we're working with a lot of veterans, we represent them individually on their appeals, if they decide to appeal, their benefits are going to be suspended during the course of the appeal.
Oh, no kidding. Well, that's a...
Yeah, they can't feed their families.
Right.
And the appeals are stretching out. They're supposed to take 6 months. They're now taking as long as 2 or 3 years.
Sure, just like the claims process.
I'm surprised it's not longer than that when it comes to the VA. They don't move fast on anything.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, veterans are just being hammered out there. And we've got veterans we're representing, like I said, all over the country. This is extremely widespread. We don't know how many thousands have been affected, but we've been contacted by a number of them, and it's continuing to go on. The program has not diminished at all. It seems to be accelerating. And we have veterans who are, you know, contacting us and saying, look, what do I do? I want to take my sons hunting. I'm being told I can't own a firearm, and if I do own a firearm, I'm guilty of a felony. And that, there's nothing wrong with these guys,
right?
Or girls.
And you know, is there any? Are you seeing any rhyme or reason to how they're being singled out?
Well, they have to be in the VA system,
right?
Okay. Now that's who they're going after at this point. Although 6 months ago I predicted that there was going to be a broadening of the program, and I'll get into that in a minute.
Okay.
But if they're in the system, they're pretty much being picked at random, as far as we can tell, and particularly if they respond positively to a question that has came out in 2009, all VA employees around the country, and not all of them do it, but we were told this came directly from the White House, a veteran goes to the VA for any reason whatsoever. It doesn't have to be health reasons. It can be to talk about benefits or for whatever reason. The first thing that they're asked are, do you own a firearm?
Yeah, totally none of their business.
Right. And if they can't say anything, it's none of their business, because then the VA will say, well, then we're not going to help you. We're not going to provide you with anything.
See, and right there, so how do they get away with that? I mean, right there, that's a violation of their rights, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, everything they're doing amounts to extortion to a great extent. We've even had veterans, and this is something that just happened here recently. We've had veterans come to me and say that the VA has told them that if they want to get around the incompetency ruling and they want to have their Second Amendment rights stored, the simple thing for them to do is just to give back all their VA benefits.
Oh.
To say, you no longer have to pay me the money I'm entitled to because of the injuries I suffered. I'll give that money back. I'll stop collecting benefits, and they'll take me off the next list. That's also extortion.
Yeah, and actually, that's again mostly like we've done quite a few shows with VA whistleblowers and things, so a lot of our listeners will identify with this. But you know, they're just not even good at extortion. They stink at lying, and they're bad at extortion. They should stop doing these things. They're just not very good at it.
No, I mean, they're not very good at it, but nobody's doing anything to them.
Yeah.
You know, all of these VA employees who were caught lying and hiding veterans' medical records,
yeah,
to the point that some veterans died as a result, none of them have been punished.
Well,
you know, there's supposed to be wholesale firing, and I think one person has been fired
yeah.
in the last year.
Well, they said 60, and then it turned out to be one. So, again, even the secretary of the VA who, I mean, actually came from outside the VA, he can't even tell the truth. But he would have been the president's pick. So as we choose a new one, just know we're going to get a new secretary. Maybe we get somebody who tells the truth. We have a lot more to cover on this subject, obviously. We've got Michael on for the entire hour. But we have to take a really quick break at this point. You're listening to We the People Radio. I know everybody's blood pressure's up. I know mine's up. You have 2 minutes to figure it out. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Switch to decaf. It's my best idea.
You're listening to We the People on AM 1460, Community Talk Radio for the North State, KCNR.
Cicada Cantina and Logan's Roadhouse presents Giveaway. Join us every Sunday at Cicada Cantina and Monday night at Logan's Roadhouse during the entire football season for a chance to win a 3-day, 2-night stay to Las Vegas or South Lake Tahoe. Every week, someone wins a trip. Come into the restaurants to find out the awesome food and drink specials only available during the game. We welcome large parties. Call and pre-book a reservation. No purchase necessary. Must be present to win. Phone Cicada Cantina at 638-4979 or Logan's Roadhouse at 221-0113.
45 years, the Reading Civic Auditorium has been an important resource in the North State for entertainment, fundraising events, trade shows, and conferences. In the past 3 years, over $1 million have been put back into this iconic structure. We invite you to be a part of the Civic's revitalization by becoming a member. We think you'll love the benefits, and your support will help to sustain its revitalization and strong community connection. Visit ReadingCivic.com or the box office to become a Reading Civic member.
Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
For 24 years, we have celebrated, and now it's time for the 25th Reading Andrea Stillwater Powwow, October 2nd through 4th at the Shasta District Fairgrounds. Experience dancers, drummers, hand games, drum contests, as well as the history of our land. Proudly sponsored by the Reading Andrea and Wind River Resort and Casino. The 25th Annual Reading Andrea Stillwater Powwow 2015, October 2nd through 4th at the Shasta District Fairgrounds. For information, call 225-8979 or visit stillwaterpowwow.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kara Tennant with CARE Animal Hospital, and I'm inviting you to join me on the Carl and Linda Morning Show. We will be discussing all of Reading's local pet needs and how to keep your pet happy, healthy, and safe. CARE Animal Hospital is a local veterinary clinic located on the corner of Hilltop Drive and Lake Boulevard. Make sure your best friend has the best possible care today.
Join Dr. Kara Tennant on Friday, October 16th at 7:30 a.m. on Free Fire Radio here on AM 1460 KCNR.
KCNR, 1460 AM. If we're not talking about it, it's probably not important. KCNR, 1460 AM.
I might have hung up my shotgun, but I didn't put it up so high that I can't reach up and get it back down if you give me
Perfect. We are talking about veterans and their Second Amendment rights. Sure, easy for me to say. With U.S. Army veteran Michael Connolly, who's also a constitutional attorney and the executive director of the United States Justice Foundation. I'm assuming we'll get to the foundation later, but right now we're fired up. Yep, we're all fired up about this this particular thing. Okay, so our question for you, Michael, can the employees, I realize the actual person who sends the letter to the veteran probably can't be held responsible necessarily, but the people who are making these policies within the agency, making these regulations, since they're obviously not, I mean, they just don't sound legal, can they be held personally responsible?
Well, probably not. They have some certain immunity, particularly the people that are responsible for this are the agency heads.
Right.
And let me tell you this, it's not just the VA we've been involved in this thing. You've got the FBI, you've got the Department of Homeland Security. Now, recently, through Freedom of Information Act requests, we found out that the BATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, is also working in this area. Now you have the Social Security Administration getting involved. So the heads of these agencies have immunity. Now, the people who are actually doing the work, independent contractors, they could, you know, be sued, but probably not held liable personally for what they're doing because they're following orders. The old standard, I'm just following orders.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do, and we are not charging any of these veterans or their families a penny for representing them. The U.S. Justice Foundation is doing it for free. We're out there trying to raise the money to file a class action lawsuit on their behalf and to try to get this stopped in its tracks and have a federal court, ultimately the Supreme Court, say that what is being done to these veterans violates their constitutional rights, not just under the Second Amendment, but also the Fifth, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments, because their medical records are obviously being turned over without their permission, and we're trying to raise the money for that. We estimate it'll cost between $250,000. We spend a lot of our time working on litigation. We spend a lot of our time at the United States Justice Foundation filing briefs in the courts of appeal around the country, the federal courts, some state courts, and also the Supreme Court. So we're looking to try to go after the government big time on this, because this is obviously illegal, it's obviously unconstitutional, and about 6 months ago on my blog, I wrote an article called Taking the Next Step, and I basically, I wrote an article called Expanding the Assault, and I pointed out that at the United States Justice Foundation, we also monitor proposed rules and regulations coming out of the federal government. And we file opposition memorandums to them when we think that they're going to violate the Constitution. We've done two in the last 6 months, one on HHS and one on BATF, which came out with new rules, which we felt were opening the door for this program to be expanded to the civilian population. HHS decided to set rules and regulations that followed an Obama executive order that basically declared that the HIPAA law, which protects our medical records privacy, no longer was applicable to anyone who had ever been depressed, ever told the doctor they were depressed, whether treated or not, anybody who had PTSD as a result of an automobile accident or being fired from a job or losing a loved one, anyone who takes certain medications, and there's a list of about 67 of them, including medication for ADD or ADHD, their medical records could no longer be considered private. And HHS could turn those records over to other federal agencies. BATF then came in and decided to change the definition of mental illness, something else that Adolf Hitler did after he became chancellor in Germany. They started using mental illness as a weapon of tyranny. And BATF said that now you can be declared mentally ill to the point of being a danger to yourself or others without any adjudication. And anybody can basically make that determination as long as they work for the federal government, even as an independent contractor. So we went after both these sets of regulations. Of course, both of them were adopted anyway. And I pointed out, though, in that article that I thought they were setting this up so that they could go after people like Social Security recipients, just like they're going after the veterans.
Sure.
Well, lo and behold, about a month ago, the Los Angeles Times breaks the story that that's exactly what they're going to do, and even points out how it's identical to what they're doing to the veterans. They're going to be contacting Social Security recipients and telling them, if you want to continue your Social Security benefits, we're going to declare you incompetent to handle your own affairs. We're going to appoint somebody to do it for you, and you can no longer own firearms. Now, the groundwork is being laid for this. By the way, some members of Congress, as a result of that article, wrote to the Social Security Administration and said, is this really true? And they got a letter back and said, yeah, it's true, but we're not going to do it to everybody.
But we're not going to do it to everybody?
Not going to do it to everybody. That basically is a defense.
Well, aren't they effectively making laws? I mean, they can't do that, can they? I mean, are these laws that they're implementing, or are they just their own rules?
Well, they're rules and regulations that carry the force of law, according to this administration. You have to understand, we have a President of the United States, an administration, and a large percentage of members of Congress who don't believe the Constitution is applicable anymore.
True.
They think they can basically do whatever they want. Now, Article 2 of the Constitution provides, for example, Article 2, Section 2 provides, for example, the President of the United States must submit all treaties to the Senate for two-thirds ratification. That wasn't done with the Iran Treaty, and in fact, Congress abdicated its responsibility under the Constitution. Article 1, Section 7 provides that the President can veto legislation passed by Congress, and they said, well, basically, we're going to allow the President to veto legislation defeated by Congress, which is not allowed in the Constitution. So you have an unlawful administration, and you have all these agencies out there saying, well, if they don't have to obey the laws, and we work for them, we don't have to obey the laws. So what they're doing is they're going after Social Security recipients. It's been reported to me by people very close to me, as a matter of fact, that they went to, I had somebody go to a new doctor recently because she had just gotten put on Medicare, and she had a doctor that was recommended to her, and she goes to this doctor, and the first thing he does is apologize to her, but say, I have to ask you a series of questions mandated by the federal government. And one of those questions was, do you own a firearm? So that's how they're going to identify firearm owners, and then they're going to make the same moves against firearm owners that they're making on the veterans. So the program is being expanded now. Who's next? People who get federally funded student loans, are they going to be told that they can't own firearms? You know, the program is getting totally out of hand, and our Constitution is being violated across the board. By the way, another thing the BATF set up was that right now, supposedly you have to be declared, adjudicated to be mentally ill to the point of being a danger to yourself or others by a court. And if you are found by a court, for example, to not be mentally competent to help yourself in a criminal trial, then you are declared incompetent and not guilty by reason of insanity, and treatment is gotten for you. But now they've expanded that definition. What happens is they're saying that you can be put on the NICS list and denied your right to own a firearm if you have ever been sent to a psychiatrist by a judge. Now, in Louisiana, where I practiced law for many years, and here in Texas, it's pretty standard procedure in family court cases for when there's children involved and a custody battle going on, for the judge to order all family members to go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist for an examination. The reports are then confidential, sent to the judge to help the judge determine if there's any child abuse going on or determine who gets custody or visitation, this sort of thing. Excuse me. And now they're saying that automatically, if that has happened to you, even as a child, if you have ever been sent by a judge to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist, even on an outpatient basis for a routine examination, even if it's found that nothing is wrong with you, the name is automatically sent to the FBI to go on the next list.
Wow.
And you're automatically put on the list?
Yep.
Wow. So if you go to a doctor and he asks you that question, are you bound by law to be truthful to your doctor?
Well, I'm saying no, because I've had people, particularly veterans all over the country, calling me up and saying, do we have to do this? And I say, tell them no, that you're not going to respond to that question, that is unconstitutional and violates your constitutional rights.
Yeah.
But what they're, what's happening to some of them, they're reporting back to me, well, they're saying if we do not answer the question, they're telling us they're going to cancel our benefits. So, again, that's extortion, and that's afraid, I'm afraid what's going to happen in the Social Security Administration and through Medicare. They're going to tell patients, okay, you can refuse to answer the question, but you can't be treated. We're not going to treat you, and we're not going to accept you as a Medicare patient.
Well, I would think that would be great grounds for an extortion claim.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's all kinds of grounds out there. We're just trying to make it, and we're trying to make it right now through the United States Senate, because there have been several pieces of legislation introduced in the last few years to try to stop this from happening to veterans. Both were defeated in the Senate by the Democrats. And, of course, we know if they pass it now, if, excuse me, it's allergy season here in East Texas. And
it's okay. We have the same problem here.
But if they pass it now, you know, the president's just going to veto it. And they're not going to have the votes to override the veto. So we're working on the legal end of it. And we're working to represent people around the country. We're telling them, you do not have to answer this question. And if they threaten to take away your benefits, to come to me immediately, because that would give us grounds for a suit for extortion, I believe. And we're ready to file that on behalf of veterans. Oh, by the way, this is, we confirmed this, two instances here in Texas and several others around the country. And veterans are being, they're going to VA, and by the way, a lot of young veterans, and this is very disturbing, a lot of the young veterans who I know, because I'm a past commander of an American Legion post, a lot of these young veterans are telling me they won't go to the VA. Even though they're entitled to VA benefits, entitled to treatment, they won't go because they don't want to be questioned about their gun ownership, and they don't want to be in the system where they can lose their gun rights. But some veterans have reported to us that they have gone to the VA and been told they have to take their clothes off, and so their bodies can be searched for radical tattoos.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Oh, my gosh.
No,
blowing my mind.
Either.
Hold on one second, Michael. We've got to take a quick break. We're sitting here staring at our computers, and Bob's waving at us. We have to take a break. Okay. We need more time with you, obviously. All right. We'll be right back in 2 minutes. We're speaking with Michael Connolly. If you know a veteran and you're listening to us on Sunday between noon and 2, you should really call them and have them tune in. Otherwise, send them a link to this show. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
I started out with a 410 and moved to a 20 gauge. Every squirrel and rabbit in Dallas County knew my name. I sat on the stand with Paw Paw from the time I was 3 years old. When I was 8, I used a muzzle loader to kill my first doe. These days I go down to Walmart and they sell them in the back. Some people want to take them away. Why don't you go bust them boys that selling crack? Go!
You're listening to We the People on AM 1460 KCNR. Our phone number is 530-605-4567 if you'd like to join in.
Jones's Fort, Redding's full-line gun shop, offers the largest selection of guns and gun accessories in the North State. We are Redding's full-line gun shop. Since 1969, we have been serving the Redding area. We at Jones's Fort take pride in being able to offer you sound advice on all your gun questions. You'll always find a good selection of new and used guns at Jones's Fort. We'll help you find the gun that is perfect for you. Have a gun you no longer need? Bring it to us. We buy, trade, and consign. Informal appraisals are given free at no charge. No gun shop is complete without expert gunsmiths. We have 4 full-time gunsmiths who can service all types of firearms. In our full machine shop, we can enhance the performance of your favorite gun or build you a custom gun to meet your needs. Marshal Dave Jones II heads up our Firearm Institute, where we do California concealed weapon classes, Utah classes, and hunter education classes. Come see us at Jones's Fort.
Want to have a great cup of specialty coffee that is reasonably priced? Well, head on down to Tobacco & Brew. Located at 2143 Hilltop Drive, Tobacco & Brew can fulfill all of your coffee and tea needs.
Then walk next door to the most complete tobacco shop in Northern California. These cigs of all sizes and flavors, a walk-in humidor that has the finest cigars as noted in Cigar Aficionado. Tobacco & Brew, coffee, wine, tea, and a fully stocked tobacco emporium. 2143 Hilltop Drive.
Open 7 days a week. We'll see you there.
Girls Inc., a program dedicated to providing a positive impact on the young girls in our community, invites you to our annual Girls Inc. Gala, Saturday, October 3rd, 6 p.m. at the Red Line in Reading. Dance your heart out to a live band and enjoy a delicious dinner. In addition to a silent auction, we will raffle off 49er and Disneyland tickets. A $10 ticket gives you a chance at 4 Disneyland tickets. A $50 ticket gives you a chance at 4 exclusive San Francisco 49er United Club level seats, plus a hotel stay. You need not be present to win. Don't miss out on this fabulous night. For gala and raffle tickets, call 527-7767 or visit girlsincnsb.org.
National news with a local view. KCNR, 1460 AM.
Alrighty, welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. There's a ton of information there about our guest this hour, Michael Conley, who's a U.S. Army veteran, a constitutional attorney, and the executive director for the United States Justice Foundation. And I added a link on the website here just a second ago to the donate page at the United States Justice Foundation. They are a 501c3. And obviously they are fighting for rights that folks who listen to this program care about. So you don't charge veterans to represent them in all this stuff, Michael, and your contact information is all on our page and on the Justice Foundation's page. How many cases do you have on this Second Amendment issue?
Well, we've got several dozen that are active at this point. A lot of them are sort of dormant because here's one of the games they play with the federal government and the VA is a veteran can't file suit on this issue until he's exhausted his administrative appeals. And that's why they're dragging these appeals out forever.
Sure.
We've got several veterans. The one right here in Texas, I'm ready to go personally and spend my own money if I have to, filing a suit on his behalf. But the appeal's just been filed about 6 months ago. And he's being told, and there's somebody from the state actually helping him with the appeal also, but he's been told that it may take two and a half more years before he gets a result. And so that means we can't file suit on his behalf until that. So we're helping veterans by telling them how to word the letters that they send to the VA, saying that, you know, I'm not incompetent. We've had some success telling veterans, for example, to specifically say in that letter that they are not willingly giving up their Second Amendment, Fourth Amendment, or Fifth Amendment rights, because that apparently is making some VA regional officers kind of nervous when we start talking about the Constitution. Most of them don't know what it is, but they hear us talking about it and they get nervous. If there are veterans out there who need our help, the way to get in touch with me personally is contact me at michael@usjf, that's the United States Justice Foundation, michael@usjfmail.net. You can also do it through the website at usjf.net, but you'll get to me probably quicker because we have so many requests coming in at michael@usjfmail.net. And we will get back to you as soon as possible. We're not a large organization. We have a fairly small staff, and we'd like to spend most of our money working on cases, working with the attorneys who we have contracts with to file appeals in constitutional cases. But we will get back to you as quick as we can, and we will do anything that we can to assist you in fighting this.
Tell us the email one more time.
Michael@usjfmail.net.
Okay, and I'm posting that too.
Michael, one of the benefits vets have is their VA loan. Have you heard of any cases where that has come into question over gun ownership?
Not yet, but that's one of the areas of concern we have because of the fact that they are expanding the program. And of course, there are a lot of veterans out there who may not be receiving VA benefits because usually you receive VA benefits if you have an illness or an injury connected to your service.
Right.
Or if you're just an elderly veteran and or if you've been injured, you're getting money every month to help you out financially. But there are thousands of veterans out there, myself included, that serve, for example, in the Army Reserve, and I was never on active duty for a full year at a time. So I'm not in the VA system, but I am in the Social Security system. And I, at one point, I was considering applying for a VA loan when we bought this ranch out here. But we're concerned about them going after everybody they can from every different direction they can. So at this point, they haven't gone after people with the VA loans, but it's certainly something that we are worried will happen.
Sure, because I would imagine that would be a big percentage of vets. I mean, that's a fantastic program. And you're right, a lot of them aren't filing for any kind of medical benefits, but, down the road, they want to buy a house. Now they've got to get in the system to get that loan, and they could be setting themselves up to be a target.
Exactly.
That's too bad.
That's unbelievable. So you guys at the United States Justice Foundation, I listed some of the things you work on in Faith and Family. Oh, sure, as I start to say this, my page fails. Here we go. Faith and Family Protection with Abortion and Defense of Marriage, Government Waste and Abuse, War Powers Resolution was the subtitle there, Media Appearances, Obama Eligibility, Securing Borders, Veterans and the Second Amendment, obviously, and voter fraud. So, would you like to enhance any one of those for us?
Well, one of the things that we're working very hard on right now is of particular importance to me is right here in Texas, and that's Obama's amnesty program.
Yes.
Because, believe me, I know what's happening here in Texas. I talk to people on the border. I know people that patrol the border, and they're telling me that right now our borders are wide open. Local authorities are doing everything they can. The Texas governor has deployed National Guard members down there. We have the Texas State Militia, which goes down there, and these are not guys that go down there armed to the teeth, ready to shoot people. They go down there with binoculars and help patrol the border. But it doesn't do any good, because if they pick up somebody on the border, the federal government orders them released. We have eyewitness testimony that gang members are coming from the Central American countries with the gang tattoos on their arms and on their faces, and they're being given a plane ticket or a bus ticket to go to any country they want to. And some of them are actually bragging about the murders they've committed in their home countries, that they're being allowed to go forward. By the way, the idea that these are Mexican nationals coming across the border for the most part, I talked to the head of one of the Texas State Militia here recently, and he was down there, and he said 2 years ago, they identified that a large percentage of the people coming across our border that they were apprehending, and they were only apprehending, they figured, 1 out of every 100 of them, a large percentage, as many as 10%, were from countries like Somalia, Yemen, Iran, Saudi Arabia. In other words, a lot of countries where it's known that they support terrorism or have terrorist organizations operating. He said they figured they were only catching 1 out of every 100, but 1 out of every 10. Now they think they're not catching but about 1 out of every 100. So they are also estimating that even back then, 60% of the people coming across the border were what they call OTMs, other than Mexican. That means we're getting a large percentage of people from Central American countries, and a lot of them are the so-called children that are coming across the border. But by the way, they're classifying a child as anyone up to the age of 23.
Oh, terrific.
That's what the federal government's doing. Anybody up to the age of 23 is classified as a child. And they're being given free transportation, free food. And, you know, we talk about veterans issues. One of the things that I've been infuriated about is that at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, they have 2,000 illegals being housed on the base. And the ICE facility down there has been transformed into essentially luxury apartments with free Wi-Fi, widescreen televisions, and, you know, free food, free medical care, free education, free toys for the children, the whole bit. Yet we have hundreds of homeless veterans in the San Antonio area. Why aren't we helping them? But that's not what's going on. So we have a Texas judge, federal judge here in Texas, has ruled that the Obama amnesty program is illegal and unconstitutional in order that it not be enforced. They are violating the court order on a daily basis, we understand. But it was appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. We filed a brief in that case, and we won that case. So now it's going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wow.
And we're going to be working directly with the Texas Attorney General and the people who, there were actually, I think, 26 states involved in that case at this point. Because it's not just the border states being affected. We're getting the immediate impact, but all the other states are going to be affected too. And now, of course, we have the Somalian refugees that are going to be coming in.
Yes.
And the other Middle Eastern refugees from Syria. And they're going to be brought in by the thousands. There's no vetting going on. We don't know who these people are. We estimate here from intelligence sources I have, because I was a military intelligence officer, intelligence sources that we have numerous terrorist cells operating within this country. And right across the border from El Paso, Texas, there is several ISIS operations going on. So we're very vulnerable here.
Well, it's just a matter. I mean, they'd be silly not to infiltrate the whole refugee situation. I mean, they're just getting it handed to them just to come over here for free. I mean, you know they've got to be putting their people in those crowds. And hell, even if 10% of them make it through, that's a lot of people.
Yep, exactly. And they're being given plane tickets when they get here. I mean, you and I cannot board an airplane
without
identification. Yet they're being given a sheet of paper, which, by the way, I can print off the Internet and sign as look up somebody's name as an immigration law judge and sign their name. And they're being given this piece of paper that says it's notice to appear. And they're being told they have to appear in immigration court somewhere down the road. It's so far backlogged now that it can be up to 3 years. And according to the immigration court people I know in the Dallas area, for example, only one out of every 10 of them ever shows up in court. So they're lost forever, basically. And they're being given these pieces of paper and a plane ticket. And with that piece of paper, they can board the plane and fly anywhere they want in the United States.
Wow. And of course, you know, what we keep being told, you know, we, the American people, just keep being told that they're just here for a better life. Well, actually, that's not technically a lie.
Well,
I mean, it is a pretty sweet deal. I mean, you get great housing, free food, plane tickets.
Even if they got it good over there, they can get it better if they just come over here.
Really up your game here.
Yeah.
We need to take one last really quick break. We're going to come back with Michael Conley, and then we're definitely having him on a different day as well, because there's lots to talk about here. Find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Listening to We the People on AM 1460, Community Talk Radio for the North State, KCNR.
Hi, Mark Story here to let you know that Haven Humane Society is taking great pride in serving the pet population and pet owners in the community. As CEO of Haven Humane, I invite everyone to check out our new adoption center and all the programs we have in place to help the animals in our care find their forever homes. And our spay-neuter clinic is also here to offer those families on a fixed income pet vaccinations and spay and neuter services. Contact Haven Humane at 241-1653 or visit us East Side Road off of 273.
Fall is just around the corner, and if you're looking for that special gift or a wardrobe fix, Dandelion is your destination. Located at 1322 Pine Street, walk into the all-new and expanded Dandelion Boutique, and you'll discover the largest selection of Brighton in the North State. Every day, there are new arrivals with the latest styles and colors. Let one of the gals at Dandelion help you select what's right for your body type. Friendly, always fashionable, Dandelion. Open 10 to 5:30 Monday through Friday and 10 to 5 on Saturday.
The sound of a delicious wine. The sound of community awareness in the fight against breast cancer. Join KCNR and Westside Wines on October 15th for Think Pink Day. Stop by between 5 and 7 p.m. at Westside Wines, located at 1872 Buenaventura Boulevard, where Linda Bott will be our celebrity host, pouring glasses of rosé to benefit our local Think Pink organization. Bottles of rosé will be 30% off, and a percentage of all the sales that night will be donated to Think Pink. Come join us, a great local business, and support this amazing cause. You can help us spread the word about the importance of early detection. Save the date, October 15th. For more information, call Westside Wines at 941-1890.
KCNR, 1460 AM, the most local programming in Northern California.
I wouldn't have thought of that for the border theme. You know, we've always maintained We the People Radio is the only place where, you know, we can kind of make blood shoot out of your eyes and you can be laughing at the same time. It's a sickness. It is. It's kind of a sickness. You can only be mad so much. Unbelievable. So, Michael, what the heck? So do you guys do any cases on this border issue? You know, are you guys litigating on any of this?
Well, just the case I mentioned, the fact that we're involved in supporting the governors who have filed suit, and
right.
We're going to be filing an amicus brief in the United States Supreme Court in support of them and pointing out how bad it is. And people that don't think we're really being affected by this in Texas, they have identified in the last several years over 600,000 crimes have been committed in the state of Texas alone. And we're talking everything from minor crimes to rape and murder by illegals.
That was kind of part of my question is, do you guys get involved in any of that?
Yeah, we can be involved in that. You know, it depends on the resources we have available at the time. Right now, we have a lot of our resources tied up in this amnesty case. We have offered to assist any United States senator that wants to step forward and sue to have the Iranian treaty thrown out on the basis that it was unconstitutionally adopted by the... Well, by what Obama and the Congress set it up, we've offered to assist in that. We're still working in the family heir cases involving legalized gay marriage and abortion, this sort of thing. So, but we're available to discuss cases with anybody who has their constitutional rights being affected. And if we can raise the money to assist in those cases, we will do so. In the case of the veterans, we're doing it regardless. You know, that's very important to me because obviously I have a couple sons that are serving. My father was a World War II veteran. He'd be rolling over his grave right now if he knew what was going on. I've written a best-selling book about his unit during World War II called Mortarmen. And, you know, I look back at those guys and the ones I interviewed. And, you know, the idea that they're now being told, the ones that are still alive, that you can't own a firearm in your own country.
Yeah.
That you want to defend, you are going to lose your constitutional rights, and they're being taken away by the own your own government that you fought to defend. That just infuriates me, frankly.
I think it infuriates everybody except the, you know, hardcore left that think none of us should own guns. But I don't know. I don't know what to say about any of that other than, thank goodness somebody's, you know, qualified to fight. You know, the rest of us are mad, but we don't have really resources to apply. But we can certainly help you. And I would imagine, you know, there is no donation to the effort that would be too small. So I would say for folks that are looking to make a good donation to a nice nonprofit that's going to do something for your constitutional rights, United States Justice Foundation should go to the top of the list. Mr. Connolly, we appreciate your time today, and we'd like to have you on again and talk
about love to have you back.
Bunches of this stuff. We could go on for hours, I'm sure.
We'd be glad to come back on any time, and thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot. I'm going to shoot you an email today, too. I've got some other stuff that I think we might be able to collaborate on. So thank you very much. This has been another episode of We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
From townhall.com, I'm Gordon Griffin. House Speaker John Boehner says he's not resigning because he was concerned about being voted out as House Speaker.
Winning that vote was never an issue. I was going to get the overwhelming number of, I'd have gotten 400 votes probably.
And the House Speaker appeared this morning on CBS's Face the Nation. Over on ABC's This Week, it was GOP presidential candidate Ben Carson making an appearance. He says he's not surprised at all by all the crowds he's getting at campaign events.
I think it says a lot for the American people because it means that they're not necessarily listening to the pundits, but they're starting to think for themselves. And that, I think, is what it's going to take to get us off of this inexorable track toward destruction that we're on.
President Obama committing the U.S. to a new blueprint to eliminate poverty and hunger around the world. The president says of the 15-year plan being discussed at the United Nations sets ambitious goals, but he tells delegates